Who is Jesus? It's a question that sparks many answers. But Jesus isn't defined by who we want him to be. He's defined by who he says he is. And in the Bible, Jesus says a lot about who he is. At the Gospel Coalition's 2024 Women's Conference, we'll look at the seven I Am statements in John's Gospel. You'll hear keynote messages from Jen Wilkin, Melissa Kruger, David Platt, and more. Join us June 20th through the 22nd in Indianapolis to feast together on the words of Jesus as we behold the truth and beauty of who he is and then believe in obedience with our whole lives. Register today at tgcw24.org. This episode of TGC Podcast is brought to you by Crossway. Navigating the Christian life in a secular world will inevitably stir questions in the lives of thoughtful believers. In Ask Pastor John, Tony Ranke summarizes and organizes 10 years of the most insightful and popular episodes of the Ask Pastor John podcast, allowing readers to quickly and systematically access Piper's insights on hundreds of topics, including Bible reading, dating, social media, mental health, and more. Pick up a copy of Ask Pastor John wherever books are sold, or visit crossway.org/plus to find out how you can get 30% off. Are you ready to be challenged in your faith? Reformed Theological Seminary's Global Program offers online courses designed for passionate, curious learners. With seasoned scholars, students can prepare for full-time ministry or to lead their weekly Bible study. RTS Global provides flexibility, allowing students to access a rich online learning experience at their own pace, with frequent enrollment dates. With courses on covenant theology, Christian apologetics, Old and New Testament books, Greek and Hebrew, you're sure to find something that interests you. Visit rts.edu/TGC to learn more about how to keep going with life while growing in your education for ministry. While you're there, you can claim a free book written by various RTS faculty with titles like The Christian and Technology, How We Got the Bible, and Being Made Right with God. Claim your free book and start your journey with RTS today at rts.org/TGC.
So when you think about creating a church culture as a leader, you're not even really thinking about who you are, although that matters a lot. Right. No one's diminishing that. But what is the team I'm trying to build, and what type of people do I want to hire and bring into this team that can create that environment for me? One of the things I would encourage the listeners to ponder is that it's not as simple as saying, do you affirm these 11 doctrinal things? Because there's these intangibles that go with healthy, godly leadership.
Welcome to the Gospel Coalition podcast, equipping the next generation of believers, pastors, and church leaders to shape life and ministry around the gospel. On today's episode, we're bringing you a conversation between Mike Kruger, president of Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Dan Doriani, a TGC council member and pastor, as they discuss strategies for fostering healthy church leadership and culture. What are the signs that a pastor is struggling in his ministry? Why is it so important for pastors to seek accountability? Dan Doriani speaks first, followed by Mike Kruger. If you'd prefer to watch the video of their discussion, visit youtube.com/thegospelcoalition or click the link in the show notes. Now let's listen in to today's conversation.
So Mike, you and I both know that pastors often struggle more than we would like. And there are signs that pastors are going to start struggling. And I notice things like sleeplessness.
Yeah.
On one side, on the other side, hyper work that causes it. Right. And others, they get burned out and you find they're coming to meetings or preaching sermons unprepared. So they can't manage their time. They can't decide whether they should work really hard or whether they're exhausted. That's one thing I notice.
Yeah.
Sometimes things like red eyes and gaining weight.
Yep.
And being short with people. Yep. Those are some signs that things aren't going well for a pastor. What do you see? Small, and you wrote a book about pastors that go far off the rails.
Yeah. One thing I'll start with is just the realization that, most pastors start off, with visions of what they want to be as a pastor and by God's grace, making our best effort to be those people. But then some pastors, as years tick by and the wear and tear happens, they find themselves turning into people they didn't expect.
Yes.
And part of it is the reasons you pointed out. It could be the exhaustion, the stress, the anxiety, the pressure. One of the reasons I wrote my book, Bully Pulpit, was that sometimes, and no one sets out to be this, pastors can begin to find that they're holding on so tightly to their ministry, their leadership, that they begin to use techniques and tactics that just really go beyond the bounds of what Scripture calls us to. And I think things can get dangerous there. People can turn into sometimes pastoral bullies as a result. And there's a level of compassion we can have on that, because there's a level in which sometimes that's happening because they're feeling so much pressure, like most people kind of lash out, you know, and so you can understand that. But at the same time, we want to help, obviously, the church be a place where that happens less. Yes. So that God's people are protected.
Yeah. So, right. I mean, we notice one of my friends said it this way. Politicians and pastors are frighteningly similar.
They are.
They start off trying to change the world and they end up being part of the problem, not part of the solution. So, you know, politicians want to be honest and just and bipartisan, and then they start worrying about getting elected.
Right.
And pastors can hold on to their office. They can also get weary of having every last person in the church being their boss, or at least everybody in the leadership team. And everybody has an opinion, and they do start to get angry and shout, and they do start to bully small B, not a big B bully, but little acts, maybe telling half-truths, telling people what they want to hear. So we both recognize small things.
Yep.
We just spend a minute. Would you tell us just a couple things about what to do if you have a big B bully, and how a church can handle it if they have someone who's not having ordinary pastoral problems or ordinary failures, real failures, but ordinary failures of sanctification?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things I think you pointed out there, which is really key, is that it's a gradation, right? It's, you know, when we talk about people with problems in the pastorate, it's not, you know, all or nothing. Right. And people have a range of different things. And like you said, some people struggle with things that are what you call ordinary problems. But then sadly, things advance to these bigger problems. And we've seen that over the last 5 or 10 years, maybe more than we had used to. We don't know, where it seems like there's more capital B bullies out there than maybe prior generations had seen. And there's ways to spot that. It's important to say that it's not mathematical.
Right.
Boy, if it were, wouldn't that be nice? If it was just like, you know, crunch a few numbers, check a few boxes, and now you know. Yeah. There's a level of subjectivity to it. We have to be very careful and cautious. But I'll mention one thing that to keep an eye out for, and that is, you know, what folks have called the relational debris field behind certain leaders, that they lead for a while and there's sort of this trail of bodies behind their leadership. And we're not talking about the normal conflict that happens in ministry, because that, look, you do ministry with sinful people and we're sinners. There's going to be conflict.
People disagree.
Absolutely. And people get hurt.
Yep.
And feelings get hurt. And those can be tough things. They can be painful things. But the kind of debris field we're talking about is sort of destroyed lives, a wreckage of lives, usually people leaving, usually broken relationships, usually unrepaired relationships, can be one of the telltale signs that you might have a leader on your hands who's heading down an unhealthy path.
Right.
And it's causing problems in the church.
Yeah. You know, one of the things about pastors is they're put on a pedestal. You're the most awesome ever. And then knocked down to, I mean, the man's just...
Yeah.
Incompetent.
It's,
I don't know
both extremes.
Why we ever hired him. At the top, there is this sort of we are special mythology, and we're special because I'm special and you're with me.
Yes.
And when that starts to happen, I know you wrote about this, but a lot of people see it. You start surrounding yourself with people who will protect you.
Yes.
And the people around
who think you're special.
Maybe, you know, the truth of the matter is maybe they are special.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, professional athletes think they're special because they are.
Yeah. They're distinctively gifted.
Yeah, they're
distinctively talented.
Gifted. Right.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you have a pastor who is distinctively talented, but then they surround themselves with people who want to protect them because they are attacked.
Yep.
And they do suffer. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure he can be at his best. But the difficulty is then when they start to go off in an unhelpful direction, the board or the elders, whoever it is that would correct them, is unwilling to hear anything negative because they're so intent on defending the leader. I'm not talking about big B bully.
Yeah.
I'm talking about a person who slowly goes in a destructive direction.
Yes. Yeah, no, this is what I call the franchise model of pastoral ministry. And the fact that you used a sports analogy is totally fitting because I think the world has an idea of how you lead an organization. The way you lead an organization is you find your superstar and then you build the organization around your superstar. And that's true for sports. That's true for CEOs of companies.
Lawyers.
Politicians. And, well, why not for the church?
Right.
And you build your entire ministry around the identity of this individual. But we all know that the track record of that is not healthy. And we know that that model is not necessarily one we find in
scripture. I mean, it's unbiblical.
Yeah, it's totally unbiblical.
Variety of gifts, not.
And what we don't realize is that not only are we hurting the church when we do that, we're actually hurting the pastor too, because you set him up for failure, because nobody can live up to that. No one can maintain that level of expectation on them. And so what happens is when things start to go bad, you end up having church splits and destructions and different things. And I wrote my book certainly about bully pastors, but I also wrote it within that trying to positively recover. What does humble leadership look like, right? What is gracious, kind leadership like Christ look like? What does gentle leadership look like? And truthfully, I think maybe the church has listened to secular models of leadership a little too much. Not that we can't learn anything from those. Right. But they have a certain vision for leaders that I don't know works very well in the body of Christ.
Yeah, and you know what's funny is we're talking about this topic. Neither of us is really an expert in this. We're both kind of exegetes and church historians.
We're biblical scholars and pastors and doing our best to think about how to solve this.
One of the things that I've noticed, when you study the Reformation is that every last leader you can, or Reformation, post-Reformation, all deeply flawed men.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, Wesley could be almost relationally clueless, violent, mm-hmm. proud, not violent physically, but sure. relationally violent. Whitfield, of course, great as he is, not only was against slavery and changed his mind, he actually advocated for the laws to be changed to allow slavery to be reintroduced for the sake of his projects.
Yep.
Luther became pretty violent in his language, or actually very violent.
And a number of his views of certain groups were very concerning.
Yes, deeply concerning. But there are also positive stories of people who turned it around, like Calvin, who, you know, was fired and given basically 48 hours to get out of town in his late 20s. And he said, hey, I don't need 48 hours. I'll be gone before you blink twice.
Right.
And then he came back. And when he came back, he was a changed man for having been under Martin Bucer, who taught him humility and grace. And he was a different man.
Yeah.
Not completely different. He still sinned. But he was different. He knew how to compromise. You know how to listen to people. So that's a fact. How can we encourage people today to have those flaws cut away as much as possible, and also to grow as much as possible?
Yeah.
Because it is a path of decline often. People start well and they slowly slip away. But people do also turn around and become better men than they were 10 or 20 years ago.
Those historical lessons have so many things we can learn from them. I mean, one of the things it reminds us of is that we're all flawed.
Yes.
Men and women, and who are sinners that God still by his sovereign grace still uses. And so even the stories of real serious failings throughout the church, we can always sort of acknowledge this is why we believe in the sovereignty of God. God can take broken, fallen leaders and still do his purposes with them. At the same time, another lesson we learn, though, is that when we do come across those fallen traits, that we don't ignore them. We don't pretend they're not there. We don't slide them under the carpet, and we don't call them good when they're not.
Right.
And I think there's a combination of acknowledging we're all in this boat together and God can still use sinful people. At the same time, honesty and forthrightness about these flaws in our past leaders and in ourselves. And then I would add to that, there's also a point where everybody has flaws in ministry, you and I and anyone else who would have this conversation. But there's also a point where the flaws lead to what we would call disqualification.
Yes, that's right.
And there is a point where you cross a line. Yep. Do you always know where that line is? No, you don't. And, you know, adjudicating bodies have to figure that out. And so there's sort of what you use the term earlier, normal failings. Can we say it that way?
Ordinary failings.
Yep. And then the failings that do cross over into the, not that you're not a Christian, not that Jesus doesn't love you, but that being a minister is something that you may have disqualified yourself for.
Yeah, let's pick up on that. So I'll stick with Calvin for a second.
Yeah.
He and Farrell actually were a team that led the church and the whole city of Geneva into great conflict.
Right.
And they had a long investigation of it. And I mean, it was pretty disastrous, but they decided they were both good and educated men and godly men, but they brought out the worst in each other, at least at that period of time. And they said, Calvin wrote a letter to Farrell saying, we are forbidden to colleague together. So you're bad for each other. That's the judgment. And so you can be friends.
Yeah.
You can write. You can visit each other.
Sure.
But you can't work together.
Yeah.
And so that was a really helpful corrective. And they both received it. Which reminds me that the number one mark in my experience of someone who's disqualified is that they won't receive criticism.
No, that's right.
And, you know, you get somebody who's caught in a lie, let's say, a pastor, I mean, and they deny that they're lying. They'll look you right in the eye and say they're not lying, and they are lying.
Yes.
And you know they're lying. Right. And you have to say to them, you can't possibly think I believe what you're saying. And, oh, yeah, it's sincere. It's like, we both know it's a lie. Right. And these are the people that end up in shipwreck.
Yes.
When they won't receive godly, loving, but firm correction.
No, one of the things I wrote about in my book on this is there's a level of defensiveness
yes.
that we all have, but there's a level of defensiveness for people that you're describing that's like a trigger point. Mm-hmm. When you criticize them or bring up something that needs to change, there's a switch that flips and they can go on the attack. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that marks some of these problematic leaders is not only are they unable to receive criticism, but they also often dole it out. There's a funny combination there.
Oh,
it's like
absolutely.
The very people who can't receive it
yes.
are highly critical of their staff, highly critical of those
yes.
under them in a way that we all know there's times to correct. There's times to shepherd and show where things need to change, but almost leading by fault finding.
Yes.
And you know that combination, you know, almost clinically is the definition of narcissism, where you yes. can't receive criticism and then dole it out all the time. And, you know, those can be really dangerous in ministries. I don't know that was true of any of these historical figures we're talking about, certainly. But I think, you know, there's certainly been cases where it seems to be true.
Yeah. Another way to say it is the better the person, the quicker they are to repent.
Yeah.
And right. sadly, the farther from God a person is,
yeah.
and I'll even say a believer, who's just strayed somehow, the slower they are to admit their sin.
Yeah.
And if anything goes wrong, of course, it's your fault,
right.
not mine. And you shouldn't even be bringing this up anyway.
So, yeah, there's an amazing ability to turn the tables.
There is.
It's like you come into the room thinking I'm trying to confront you with, and you leave feeling like you're
gently,
the problem. And you're
gently.
Like, yeah, and you're like, how'd that happen? How did I leave now that I'm the problem? And you're like, how does a person have the ability to do that? It's like, is there a class they take where they learn how to turn the tables?
Yeah.
But it is a skill. Yeah, so there's always this give and take. And this is the complexity of these ministry scenarios. And this really leads to one of the things that you and I were discussing before we got started today is what kind of things can churches do? What kind of structures can we put in place and watch out for to help minimize this from happening? Because I think we're just acknowledging that even people who start off good have the potential to end up in unhealthy places. And some that start off good can even get more godly.
Yes.
And part of what makes the difference is whether there's things around them
right.
that can make that decision. You have any
I have a couple really practical
thoughts?
Things, and I know you
yes.
agree with them because
yeah.
I've read it in your book.
Yeah.
Number one is genuine annual reviews.
Yes.
In a Presbyterian system,
yes.
elders would seriously review the pastor every year and ask, not just how's your wife doing, how are your kids doing,
right.
what's your schedule, but probe into some of the areas that they've detected. For example, somebody's working too hard.
Right.
Or if maybe they noticed that there's some issue in their family, you know, how's it going with you and your wife, your kids, yeah. whatever the case may be. Maybe they see some unhealthy habits,
yeah.
even right. physical habits, and they press. That's one. But I also believe in talking to staff.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
And, you know,
yeah.
whether you call it a 360 or whatever
yep.
terminology you use, you should definitely, especially if there's a staff of size,
mm-hmm.
obviously there's lots of solo churches and there's, you know, one part-time administrative assistant. But if it's a church of size, which is where things, you know, where pastors go wrong
sure.
more,
sure.
I think you should interview multiple staff.
I think that's exactly
informally.
Right. Yep.
How's it going? But
yep.
also if there's any hint that things are going poorly, a formal interview, you know, once a year and
yep.
follow up on it.
No. And one of the things that I've seen about those interviews is the staff have to also, when they're asked how it's going, be assured that they can safely
yes, yes.
and honestly answer.
Yes.
Because I've seen time and time again doing 360 reviews where the lower staff are very hesitant to say anything
yes.
because the person interviewing them, they have the impression is the best friend of the senior pastor. And they're like,
yes.
well, wait a second, how safe is this? How yes. how neutral is this?
That's why you have to
yeah.
have elders
yes.
who aren't the
That's
buddies
right.
of the lead pastor, which we're not asking for hostility between
of
them.
Of course not. Yeah.
We're asking for good faith oversight.
Yeah. And this is one of the reasons I mentioned in my book that, you know, is there a way we could rethink the way we pick our elders and, you know, consciously trying to not just create a band of my favorite people, Around the senior pastor. And obviously, like you said, you're not looking for people to be antagonistic. That's a whole nother problem. And I know that a lot of pastors probably listening to this thing, are you kidding? My elders are my biggest thorn in the side, right? And they're not protecting me. They're sort of after me. And I totally get that.
Yes.
But there is a sense in which independent voices,
yes,
if I could say it that way, on the session or on the elder board are so critical here so that they can listen to the staff genuinely, not beholden to one man or one person. And then the staff knows that they're not. They can see it played out that, oh, this is a place where I can really be honest about what concerns me. And I know that I'm not going to get fired a week later after bringing it up, you know? Right. And I think that's a really important thing.
Yeah. And of course, the best way to have a session formed is by watching the leaders God's already raising up
right.
in the youth ministry, children's ministry, adult discipleship. And the elders are not selected by the pastor. They're recognized.
Correct.
By the whole church.
Right. They're not made elders in one sense. They're already functioning like
yeah.
that.
We're recognizing what's already happening.
One more thing on the annual reviews I want to throw in there, and that is, and this is, I know this sounds like a micro step, but I just want to encourage the listeners to think about this. So many churches do the annual review process in a subgroup of the elders, usually called the personnel committee.
Right.
And usually three or four people are the ones that review the pastor. And the whole elder board never sees the reviews on an annual basis. And it's sort of hidden in a committee to some extent.
Yeah.
Well, why that's a concern is that it's typical that when things finally blow up in churches sometimes, the large group of the session goes, I'm shocked. Where did this come from? And you realize it's been going on for 10 years, but it's been sort of hidden away over in a personnel committee. So one piece of advice I would give, I think is wise, is that when the annual reviews come in, they should be shared with the entire session. So that the entire session can see them and can say, okay, I understand. Our pastor's not a perfect guy. He's got challenges like all of us, but we know what they are. We can pray for him. We can help him. And it wouldn't be a shock later down the road.
That might also be implicitly an argument for sessions that aren't too large.
I think you could say that, sure.
You know, there are sessions of, I had a session of 36 at one point. And it's almost impossible to really dig into things. So it may be at least an executive committee that hears everything.
Correct.
Yeah, good point. Thanks for that. Yeah, I would say positive things include just basic decency and following ordinary rules. You know, if you visit somebody in the hospital, you say to the family, okay, are you sleeping and eating and not wearing yourself out?
Right.
So I think it really starts with the most basic things, like are you reading the Bible and praying and meditating apart from your sermon preparation?
Right.
What are you reading? Are you only reading to prepare? Or are you reading for your soul?
Yep.
Assuming the pastor is married, most are, not all. Tell me about your relationship with your wife. What's the quality of your time together?
Yeah.
I encourage all pastors, make sure you're with your wife. One way to say it is, if you don't have sweet time with your wife and dates, she'll point it out and then you'll give the same amount of time and it'll be sad. Worrying about your problems. So get ahead of the curve and have a good time with your wife. You know, if you have children in the home still, you know, have little dates, do special things with your kids.
Yeah.
Just the most basic practices, reading the Bible, praying, meditating, confessing, celebrating.
Yeah.
Can I just push that for a second?
Yeah.
I think I'll just say one word.
Yeah.
I find not only pastors are beaten down by their elders, but elders are weary. Elders need to be praised and thanked for the work they do.
They do.
And if you have a staff, and not everybody has a staff, but if you have a staff, children's work, youth work, administrative work, if you have a finance director, a lot of it's very thankless.
It is.
And the pastor gets the credit, or pastors, if there's multiple pastors, get the credit. And pastors have a unique capacity to take the time to label the excellencies of the people who work with them and to some degree under them, and to assure them their gifts are absolutely essential in the church. And that, I think, has a pervasive influence. It helps us so we're not becoming critics.
No.
We bless our wives, our children, and we bless the people who work for us and with us.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I mentioned a minute ago about unhealthy pastoral trends is over-criticism.
Yep.
And you mentioned a swing towards a more healthy trend, which is look for ways to praise and affirm those you work with and that are under you. And I think this is just such a forgotten thing. And I understand why it is, because we're so busy, we're so swamped and so exhausted. The idea of, you know, we feel unthanked. And so we're not, when you feel unthanked, you're not going to go thank other people. And this is one of the challenges of the weight of pastoral ministry. I get it. We're in it together. But it's amazing how much a word of thanks and affirmation to the staff really encourages them. They feel seen by the pastor. It's a gentle, warm way to lead positively. I would also encourage pastors to look to thank their female staff.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that we're seeing more and more churches, which is great, is female paid staff doing a variety of jobs. And sometimes they feel perhaps not always seen by the senior pastor because he's dealing with the elders and the other pastors. That just a word of affirmation to your female staff can make a huge difference.
It really doesn't take long to observe. Just watch what they do well that you couldn't do.
Correct.
Or maybe you could, but you probably can't. And they do it well, and the body of Christ needs what they do. I mean, just something like take care of newborns to five-year-olds.
Yeah.
You don't get a ton of praise for that.
No.
But it's so important. I mean, a healthy church has to have good care of the little ones. Thank those who take care of the little ones.
You know, one thing in all of this, and this may be a good way to land the plane on this conversation, is, you know, wrapped up in discussions of healthy ministry, unhealthy ministry, that, you know, we could talk about structures and 360 reviews and how to form a session, and all those things matter. And I wrote about a lot of those, as you know. One of the nebulous things here that I'd love to get your thoughts on, Dan, is the effect that church culture has on this whole thing.
Yes.
So it's not so much a church structure, although that's part of it. It's not even really so much a church theology, although that's certainly really important.
Right.
Isn't it true churches have vibes and ethoses and cultures, and some feel freeing and warm and inviting, and some feel heavy and maybe even at times oppressive? I wonder your thoughts on, do pastors think enough about that, you know, and how to form and shape that? Because I wonder if we're missing a piece of the puzzle here, because I've heard people say it, that church culture trumps just about everything when you try to get stuff done, if it's a bad, unhealthy culture versus if it's a good one.
That's right.
So let me just say, this is maybe a little bit too particular. I just finished a fantastic 2-year interim part-time while still being a professor at a church that had and has a terrific vibe. And it lost it for a while, COVID and some things, you know, there's some strife that occurred. And so they lost their true nature. But there were several people on the staff who were just, I'll say, by God's grace and gifting, extremely positive people.
Yeah.
And what you have to do is let them flourish and tell them that their positive spirit, I'm going to interrupt myself. Most pastors are introverts, especially in large churches.
They are.
You have to be willing to sit for 18 hours and work on a sermon. That means you're an introvert.
Yeah.
So you're probably not going to convey, it's not a criticism, just a realistic fact of life. You're probably not going to convey warmth and enthusiasm, but churches need warmth and joy.
They do.
And so you find your joyful people, which this church has in abundance, and you label it, and you tell them, you bring a positive spirit. You bring the joy of the Lord. You bring the gift of encouragement and affirmation, and I'm thankful for that. You keep it up.
Yeah.
You make us who we are.
Yeah.
And then you probably have some elders who are maybe minded to be watchmen or critical, but you also have others who are enthusiastic and positive, and they see the good, and support, protect, and encourage them.
Yeah.
So you may not have personally, most pastors actually, I don't think, have a great personal vibe.
Right.
Be a people, I'm not saying they're bad, but they're not great. Be a people around you who do have a great vibe.
No, that's right. So when you think about creating a church culture as a leader, you're not even really thinking about who you are, although that matters a lot.
Yes.
No one's diminishing that, but what is the team I'm trying to build?
Right.
And what type of people do I want to hire and bring into this team that can create that environment for me? And I think one of the things I would encourage the listeners to ponder is that it's not as simple as saying, do you affirm these 11 doctrinal things? Because there's these intangibles that go with healthy, godly leadership. You know, the spirit of things, the ethos of things, the way that is manifested is so important. And I know there's a level of subjectivity to this, right? You're like, well, what do you mean exactly?
Yeah.
And I think that's exactly why it matters so much, because sometimes if it's subjective, we dismiss it as a factor we're not going to consider.
Right.
And I think when you walk into the doors of a healthy church, there is something there that sometimes you can't quite put your finger on. Mm-hmm. And it's not just, do you affirm the Westminster Confession of Faith or not? There's something else going on there. And, mm-hmm. and those are the things I think we need to consider as leaders.
Yeah, and it even includes things like picking your greeters very carefully.
It's exactly right. I tell people the first face you see on Sunday morning, you better pick that person very carefully, because that's the impression of the church they're going to have.
Yeah, and welcome your visitors every week and say how glad we are to have you and so forth. Yeah. That's good. Good. I always enjoy talking to you, Mike.
Great time, Dan. Thanks for the conversation.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of the Gospel Coalition podcast. Check out more gospel-centered resources at thegospelcoalition.org.